Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute at the Gallipoli Club, where Frank Brennan makes a welcome return and Megan Davis makes a welcome first up appearance. As you know, Frank Brennan's a Jesuit priest, Professor of Law at the Australian Catholic University, and adjunct professor at the College of Law and the Australian National Centre for Indigenous Studies at the Australian National University in Canberra. He's written many books, and he's here on the occasion of the launch of his most recent book, No Small Change, The Road to Recognition for Indigenous Australians. And Dr. Davis is also known to many of you, but she is International Law Scholar and Director of the Indigenous Law Centre at the Faculty of Law at the University of New South Wales. She's an expert member of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in New York and was a member of the Prime Minister's Expert Panel on the Recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Peoples in the Australian Constitution. So we're going to lead off with Frank Brennan, with Father Brennan, follow up with Dr. Davis, and we'll come to questions and discussion as usual. Frank Brennan, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. It's great to be with you. I honour the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and it's wonderful to be here in the Gallipoli Club, marking the centenary of Anzac Day. And thank you very much, Gerald and Anne, for the invitation. And we gather here on the 48th anniversary of the successful 1967 referendum. And I must say, personally, it's a great honour to share the dais this evening with Professor Megan Davis, an Aboriginal Professor of Law, who is one of the fresh new leaders of Indigenous Australia and one of the bold new public intellectuals in the Australian public square. It's now more than 3 years since the expert panel set up by the Gillard government, and of which Megan was a member, reported on how the Constitution might be amended, providing recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. The Abbott government seems to have been waiting for some sort of consensus to emerge. I'm one of those non-Indigenous Australians who's been frustrated for some years at what I regard as the appalling state of national Indigenous policy, no matter who's been in government, but have long wondered what a well-meaning white fella might be able to contribute. I moved to Canberra about 6 or 7 years ago, and one of the things which I found an advantage in Canberra was that you have not only the National Library and the National Archives, but also the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies. And I thought it worthwhile, as a well-meaning white fella, to try and go back and learn some lessons of what happened in Australia after 1967. You will recall that in 1967 there was a successful referendum which was very modest in terms of what it did with the Constitution. But that modest constitutional change won overwhelming national support. And it was that overwhelming support which provided the political imperative for change. One of the not appreciated historical aspects about that referendum is that Sir Robert Menzies, and I know Anne Henderson, who's here, is a great expert on him, but he was one who was rather wary about the proposed 1967 referendum. When it was put to him when he was Prime Minister, he warned that there could be adverse consequences of the amendments that were proposed. But basically people said, don't worry, and it was years later when the High Court said that Sir Robert Menzies was right, that key Indigenous leaders said, we need to improve on what was done in 1967. Well, if it was the vote which provided the political momentum, I think the real catalyst for change was when Harold Holt decided to set up a three-member council for Aboriginal affairs. and you'll bear in mind this was the 1960s, so of course, and it was of course in those days, there were no Aborigines on the Council for Aboriginal Affairs. But there were three extraordinarily wise and talented white men. And they were Dr. H.C. Coombs, who had the extraordinary experience of post-war reconstruction and work at the Reserve Bank, a very distinguished diplomat, Barry Dexter, and the very luminary anthropologist, Professor W.E.H. Stanner. Now, I had the good fortune to have known all three men. In fact, I preached the homily at the funeral of H.C. Coombs here in St. Mary's Cathedral. I received the last letter that W.E.H. Stanner ever wrote, which was at the end of a murder trial in which I had been involved in Queensland, where a young Aboriginal man had killed his woman partner on a remote Aboriginal community in Cape York. Stanner wrote to me saying how strange it was that he'd given almost identical evidence before a judge in the Northern Territory 50 years before, and it didn't seem to be accepted. He said, "Isn't it remarkable how quickly things change?" And then Dexter, an amazing man, 94 years of age, he's still alive there in Canberra. During preparation of this book, I was able to meet with him regularly, taking the Lamingtons, and we'd share morning tea and reflect on those many years of experience between 1967 and 1976 with the preparation of the Northern Territory Land Rights Act. My great insight from the work they did was that it was essential that there be three individuals like that who were a constant thorn in the side of the Commonwealth and state bureaucracies. They fought for 7 years to get a statutory charter. They were never given one. The Whitlam government finally in 1974 gave them a letter setting out what their roles were, but at every turn they had trouble with departments like Interior. But as I argue in the book, they helped to move Australia from the terra nullius mindset to that of land rights, and from the assimilationist mindset to that of self-determination. I think everyone, they included, would concede they didn't do much about setting the limits on those concepts, and here we are, 40 years after the passage of the first Northern Territory land rights legislation, where if we are attentive to Indigenous voices, they constantly say that they are land rich but dirt poor, and we hear from Indigenous Australians that one of the things that troubles them most is that when we have a Prime Minister who speaks of lifestyle choices, there are questions as to who is at the table as the policy decisions are made with the allocation of resources. So it's with that background that I've written this book, No Small Change. I've dedicated it to a young Aboriginal man who took his own life at Daly River, Ngaiu Nambiyu in the Northern Territory. I've just returned from a year at Boston College, which was splendid but very cold, but I was privileged to be able to go straight to Daly River, spend a few days there and present the book to the family of that young man. His aunt is a distinguished Aboriginal artist in the Northern Territory, Miriam Rose Ungermer. She has established a foundation to assist communities who are confronting the plague of youth suicide. And I was able to speak at their fundraising dinner in Darwin, and after doing that, to return south to present the book to Barry Dexter and to Mrs. Stanner, the widow of W.E.H. Stanner. The argument I put in the book is that basically, with the lessons from 1967, I think, if I may say, the art of statesmanship of constitutional change is to hold in balance Indigenous aspirations, constitutional architecture, and public sentiment. And constitutional change is very difficult. What we Australians have to accept is that there is literally no Australian voter under the age of 56 who has ever voted in a successful referendum. So we have to admit we are a nation that has something of a sclerosis when it comes to constitutional reform. And we further have to acknowledge that there is no Australian under the age of 69 years who voted in the successful 1967 referendum. As we move forward to consider constitutional change now, one of the big changes, as I've already intimated, is that, of course, we must primarily be attentive to Indigenous voices. And what I argue in the book and what I've been arguing on media in the last week or so is that I think we are at a real fork in the road. And I think at this fork in the road, there is basically a choice as to where the nation goes, but I think that choice primarily lies with the Indigenous leadership. One fork in the road, I think, is fairly clear, fairly simple, and fairly short. And it's the road to the date of the 27th of May, 2017, exactly 2 years hence, a Saturday, the day on which we vote, the 50th anniversary of the 1967 referendum. Now, I think there is some appetite in the Australian community for saying, well, can we get something right by the 50th anniversary of the 1967 referendum? Now, with that fork in the road, what I argue in the book is that if we look at the work done by the expert panel, and if we look at what has been done unanimously by the Australian Parliament since then, I think, consistent with constitutional architecture and public sentiment, we could look at a referendum which proposed an acknowledgement of Aboriginal realities at the beginning of the Constitution. That is, an acknowledgement of the fact that, of course, they are the first occupiers of the land, that, of course, they have continuing relationships with lands, and also that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have continuing cultures, traditions, and heritage. I think also that it is possible to amend Section 51 of the Commonwealth Constitution, which sets out the Commonwealth powers, and I think instead of an old-fashioned power to make laws with respect to the people of any race, because the concept of race is clearly outdated, then I think a power to make laws with respect to the very matters that have been acknowledged would be a way in which to show our appreciation of, as a nation, of the Indigenous presence. There's also a very outdated provision, Section 25, which is low-hanging fruit. It's actually a provision which took its derivation from one of the post-Civil War amendments in the United States, which basically said that if a state was not to include people of a particular race in voting for the state house, then there would be that much less representation in the federal house. Now, it's a provision that's never been used, never will be used, and clearly can be easily abolished. The big issue then becomes what can be done in addition to that, or, to put it differently, if that's one fork, one of the forks, what's the other fork in the road? Now, I think that's a longer road. I think it's less determinate. And we at this stage don't know what the content would be. But I think what we are hearing very clearly from key Indigenous leaders, even though there's not unanimity at this stage, is that they want something more than formal constitutional acknowledgement in the Constitution and a simple reworking of the Commonwealth power. Now, in terms of the something more, I think it's fair to say that there have been two conglomerations of thought. One, and it's been espoused by the expert panel and also by Megan, who's with us this evening, and George Williams, the idea that you would put into the Constitution a provision which banned racial discrimination. On its face, I think that's a very attractive idea. I do not think it's achievable, though, by May 2017. And so that's why I put it as part of the other fork in the road. And let me explain briefly why. I do have the temerity to suggest that in 1996, in delivering the Roma Mitchell Oration, I actually put forward such a proposal for such a clause. But I've changed my mind, and very radically. Why? Because after I delivered that Roma Mitchell Oration, the High Court delivered its decision in the Wick case. And then in 1998, there was a very bitter debate in the Australian Senate about John Howard's amendments to Paul Keating's Native Title Act. Now, the key provision is Section 7, and that is a debate about the relationship between the Native Title Act and the Racial Discrimination Act. Suffice to say that Bob Brown for the Greens and the Democrats proposed a very simple amendment to say the Native Title Act should be strictly subject to the Racial Discrimination Act. Now, that was judged unacceptable, not just by the Howard government, but by the Labor opposition, because it would not render sufficiently certain future dealings with land, particularly on pastoral leases, that is, future mining and pastoral activity. So, as I say, and not glibly, if there were to be a move to this sort of constitutional provision, we would need to convince the major political parties to amend Section 7 of the Native Title Act. Now, to do that, you would first of all have to have on board the Business Council of Australia, the National Farmers Federation, and the Minerals Council. Now, I'm sure they're all very reasonable individuals, but I suspect it would take more than a two-year period to effect that. The second conglomeration of thought is around the view which has been put of late, particularly by Noel Pearson, to say that what is necessary is that Aboriginal people should have a place at the table. There should be some form of Indigenous council for dealings with Parliament when looking at future provisions relating to Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. I think that is also a very good idea, but once again, I do not think it possible to work something like that into the Constitution by 2017. I think what may be possible by 2017 is what I've described, the acknowledgement, the amendment of Commonwealth power, the repealing of Section 25, and perhaps the setting up of a statutory Aboriginal Commission, which then, as I would say, would be road-tested over some years. And then once road-tested, it may be possible down the track to propose it for the Constitution. But at the moment, if I might just highlight a few key problems that would need to be addressed before the Australian punters were satisfied with putting it in the Constitution. One is that Mr. Pearson has said that the body would be partly elected. Well, those of you who were living here last year, as I would not, would know that one Senator Jackie Lambie, at one stage in her maiden speech, said that she was Aboriginal. And there were some very angry reactions to this by the Tasmanian Aboriginal groups. Now, basically, the question about whether Jackie Lambie could vote for such an organisation and whether she could be a member of such an organisation would ultimately require some sort of resolution by the courts. Second, and more substantially, we've had the experience of ATSIC. Now, ATSIC was a body which had federal commissioners, but it also had regional councils and local councils. The problem always with Aboriginal representation at the table is the legitimacy of those with the national voice having the local connectedness. Now, how do you postulate a national Aboriginal commission which does not have a series of regional councils and local councils? Serious question. Finally, I'd say that the experience of 67, of Stannard, Dexter and Coombs, was that dealing with the politicians in terms of making legislation was the icing on the cake. The real work, the day-to-day work, the grunt work, was taking on the bureaucrats day in and day out in changing mindsets, not just within the Commonwealth, but within state instrumentalities. So if you were to have an Indigenous organisation, then it would need to be resourced to be able to do that. All of these things, I say, no doubt it's worthy, but the prospect of putting it in the Constitution by May 2017, not on. So, question. When Indigenous leaders wake up on the 28th of May 2017, would they prefer the Constitution we presently have as they work towards that more distant destination? Or would they prefer a Constitution which now acknowledges them, which repeals Section 25, and which stipulates that the Commonwealth power is in relation to the matters acknowledged? And on that, we await the word from Indigenous Australia, and I, as one of the white fellows, will be happy to go with whatever they propose. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Just before I introduce Megan Davis, I should say Dr. Davis is here tonight as co-author with George Williams of Everything You Need to Know About the Referendum to Recognise Indigenous Australians. So, Megan Davis will be here any time soon. Here we go.
I have props, right?
You got props?
I've got props.
props. I've got two books. There you go.
I do apologise for being late, but I think it's... do you want to hold the props? It's a persuasive reason why we need the light rail. Because you can't get anywhere from UNSW on Anzac Parade quickly. So it's... And it took me 45 minutes to get here. Anyway, I won't complain. So, thank you for having me. Like Frank, I note that today is the 48th anniversary of the 1967 referendum. And I also note that this is the 35th anniversary of the first State of Origin. And tonight is the night that my team, Queensland, we'll be regaining our shield, which we accidentally lost last year. So my comments will be very brief. As Frank knows, I grew up in Queensland, in southwest Queensland, and rugby league was the sport that was played on the missions and reserves all over Queensland. So it is a very, very serious business in Aboriginal Australia. So I will keep my comments as brief as I can, and to be... Frank, pardon the pun, they're slightly discursive because there's been a lot going on in constitutional recognition in the past few weeks. So from the outset, I suppose, I wanted to identify two, I think, really important things that Frank said. One was, I think, identifying the successes of ATSIC, because I think one of the, I think Australian public policy is for the poorer, that there's been literally no academic or scholarly analysis on ATSIC and what it achieved and what it did. It only focuses on the negative. And in fact, it was quite an innovative body. And as people like Noel Pearson and Nicholas Rothwell have written lately, it was a mistake to abolish it. So I acknowledge that comment. In addition to what you suggest about a broad-based discrimination provision, because I think a broad-based discrimination provision in the Constitution would be overwhelmingly supported by the Australian people, and I agree about that. So constitutional reform as it relates to Australia's First Peoples is always a very difficult thing to discuss in Australia because even the most pedestrian reform, such as many that are found in other comparative liberal democracies, are regarded as radical in Australia. So I've kind of come to this conclusion that my academic career in Australia is that as a radical. And the greatest indicator, I suppose, of the parallel universe that Australia inhabits on Indigenous rights is probably the fact that symbolic or weak form recognition is regarded as a moderate approach. And I think that this country can do better. Charles Taylor, in his very famous book on recognition, The Politics of Recognition, wrote that written constitutions are a major site of contestation in the political struggles of marginalised groups to have their identities respected within public institutions. So constitutional accommodation of these identities and the manifestations of culture are not uncommon around the globe. And I think that we can all agree that it's important to continually think about how we improve the way our liberal democracy runs. But I suppose little did we know when we were lumbered with the term recognition from a previous government, and recognition being a legacy of the 1999 failed referendum, recognition was not a central plank of the Aboriginal political movement. It is a word that we have inherited. That word would in some way become a straitjacket and now has influenced the debate itself. So on the face of it, the word recognition means to recognise, and it's not surprising that people then think we're talking about the kind of symbolic recognition that people are supporting. However, when it comes to constitutional accommodation of groups like Indigenous peoples, when it comes to comparative constitutional law, there is in fact a recognition spectrum. Strong recognition is something like agreements or treaties or other constructive arrangements or Indigenous parliaments or entrenched Indigenous rights or an Indigenous parliamentary body. So it means a redistribution of public power within the state. The weaker end of the spectrum is non-constitutional symbolism. So it's kind of the kind of language it makes reference to Indigenous people's unique relationship with ancestral lands and waters, for example. But there's nothing constitutional about it. It's merely symbolism. So a cursory glance of Indigenous media suggests to any interested person that Indigenous Australians are very ambivalent about the current debate. They feel that the current debate is steering toward what is symbolism, which Frank noted, and that is with limited input from them, and they are overwhelmingly rejecting a minimalist or weak form of recognition. From the Indigenous media that I have surveyed, symbolic recognition is not seen as a step forward. It's not seen as a step forward simply because it is something, and Indigenous people are being told something at this point is better than nothing, and that is being rejected. Look, there are salutary benefits of constitutional recognition. However, there is a downside, and as Dylan Lino argues, who's an Australian scholar at Harvard and Melbourne Law School, argues, he says that the pursuit of wholly symbolic recognition in written constitutions often neglects the valid grievances about how power is wielded by the state over the group in question. So he argues that actually symbolic recognition can have negative effects if you're ignoring what it is that people are arguing for. So why do I say this? What are those valid grievances? And I want to make some comments here in a similar vein to some I made earlier in the week for this Reconciliation Week, because I think they bear repeating. Why are we here? Well, we know that Australia has a well-known or well-entrenched culture of rights scepticism. Kind of curious to some extent for a nation that developed very strong economic and social rights, such as labour force rights, well before they emerged in any post-World War II United Nations human rights framework. But of course, when it comes to equality before the law and non-discrimination, we have not done so well, and I think Noel Pearson very well captured that in his Gough Whitlam Memorial. But he noted that the last vestiges of compulsory segregation lingered well on into the 70s until the passage of the Racial Discrimination Act. So we all know that the protection era, which is the compulsory segregation, racial segregation of Aboriginal people in Australia, began around the 1890s, although earlier if you read some historians, to ostensibly 1967. And that overlaps with this Australian policy period of paternalism and the assimilation period. And I'm sure I don't have to tell, you know, a room like this that our rights-reluctant culture is very much sustained by a very strong commitment to parliamentary sovereignty in our political and legal system. So it's an almost intact 1901 Dicean notion of parliamentary supremacy that holds that Parliament should remain unencumbered by any checks and balances or fetters, but for the doctrinal kind of limitations, such as separation of powers and the Constitution. And we teach that each year at UNSW Law to our public law students. We talk to them about A.B. Dicey, who influenced the drafters of the Constitution, and how the theory goes that federalism and the common law should be able to do the work of rights protections because of a number of reasons, including that parliamentarians will not do the wrong thing by people. And we know that Dicey felt that a Bill of Rights is an admission of failure, that politicians won't do the right thing by people. But we also know that, you know, other comparative liberal democracies have dispensed with this absolutist notion of parliamentary sovereignty. I don't have to go through the whole list, but the US obviously early on, Canada, New Zealand and the United Kingdom, although there is a debate there now about the Human Rights Act. But the Australian polity resists any federal and parliamentary power that wasn't there in 1901, except for trade agreements, of course. So the bottom line, though, is we eschew rights entrenchment and are sceptical of any federal and parliamentary power. But the scepticism collides with another very important factor, which is by no means, again, unique to Australia, and that is Western liberal democracies are essentially procedural democracies. They're ballot box democracies. So, and it is a challenge of all, I think, minimalist liberal democracies that limit citizens' participation to the ballot box at multi-party periodic elections how you pay more attention to the quality of the decision making that happens between elections. And we're not alone there. There's, you know, voluminous literature about how to improve the quality of decision making by Parliament between the ballot box process. There's many opportunities that I'm not going to run through: submissions to Parliament, protest letters to the editor. I don't have to spell those out, and anyone who surveys the civic surveys regularly on Australia would know that Australians don't perform too well on the tenets of liberal democracy, such as things like protest. But this is the problem of all liberal democracy. So it pushes politics to become attuned to what political scientists called utilitarian calculation. So it means that this is where the disparaged minority group comes from, falls outside of the interests of Parliament. So most liberal democracies do try to temper that in some way, that majoritarianism in some way. Some have electoral systems that encourage more independent or minority voices. Many have bills of rights or charter of rights or human rights, that kind of fetter. And then for Indigenous peoples, liberal democracies have things like agreements, constructive arrangements, treaties, reserved seats, Indigenous parliaments, and the list goes on. But we have resisted that kind of structural accommodation of Indigenous peoples too. But to go through all of that is to say that that is why we are here. We are here because of that kind of hard-nosed structural problem. We're not necessarily here for recognition in a symbolic sense. We are here to find ways to better accommodate Indigenous peoples within the Australian democracy. And I think, as Frank has already summarised, 116A and the parliamentary body proposed by the Cape York leader, Noel Pearson, are two ways that Indigenous peoples have conceived of as ways to temper the excesses of majoritarian democracy. So Indigenous peoples are saying the ballot box isn't enough. We can't influence the ballot box. Our democratic culture poses that problem. We're 2% of 22 million people. So moving on from that, I think it's probably, and Frank, forgive me for this, a bit erroneous to regard Indigenous proposals for reform as just mere aspirations, because I think you'd agree that they're actually very concrete, they're very substantive, they're very advanced, they're very carefully considered and well thought out proposals for law reform. So I wouldn't describe them as aspirations. And I think that much of the trajectory since 1967 in terms of Aboriginal political advocacy has been aimed at that ameliorating the harsher tendencies of Parliament and the kind of recognition through rights of manifestations of our culture. But we see this step of this current constitutional reform step, we see it on a very long trajectory. So we see it from first contact to the conciliation phase, to the killing times or the frontier wars, to the protection era and the assimilation period, to self-determination, and to what the Prime Minister says is now, or has called himself, now a period of neo-paternalism. So we see it on a trajectory. We don't see it as since 67. And I think as a member of the expert panel, we did note in going to Aboriginal communities, there was a much stronger, I think, knowledge of civics and Australian history than some of the other communities we visited. So that was an interesting thing. So Frank has effectively said, you know, we're at a fork in a road, but really Indigenous leaders are now at a fork in the road and we await their call. And of course, as Frank would know, I don't agree with that. I don't think that we are at a fork in the road. We might be disengaged because of the gutting of Indigenous funding through the Indigenous Advancement Strategy or, you know, the amending of heritage laws that protect sacred sites from damage, the very sacred sites that people wish to recognise in the Constitution. I think a more considered analysis is that, in fact, Indigenous leaders do have quite a detailed, you know, idea of the way forward, and we have been doing this for years. And that's what my props were, Frank, as you would remember. But, you know, we have, after the Mabo decision, there was a three-pronged approach, which was the Native Title Act, the Indigenous Land Fund, and the Social Justice Package. I mean, this is an Indigenous consultation-based document that has a very clear path forward for settlement, including principles of engagement. The same too with the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation that actually included consultation from non-Indigenous Australians too. So I would just say actually they really are quite advanced proposals for reform. Now, in relation to the model, and you've raised the issue of Jackie Lambie, but, you know, I just don't think that this is something new in our community. We have a very effective way of dealing with identity, and I think that kind of thing would be dealt with if this model was the one that went ahead. And I suppose, to some extent, I find that comment a bit reminiscent of the comments that people made about Section 116A when it came out, you know, that it would lead to the introduction of child brides or spearing. Because I don't think, you know, and I don't think, Frank, you would disagree with that you can't admonish Aboriginal people for wanting Section 116A in the Constitution. We've been singled out for racially discriminatory treatment or adverse treatment by the government on numerous occasions. And the era of the protection era is very alive in the minds of Aboriginal people. And I can see by Jared's body language that I'm running out of time. So I'm going to really truncate this and say, look, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and wellbeing is not just about statistical quality, and I know that a lot of the public discourse is just about close the gap now. There is actually very serious unfinished business to address. And I think pretending like the agenda doesn't exist is doing great damage. What we're hearing from Aboriginal communities is that they see a dissonance between recognising us in the Constitution and the kinds of legislation and policy that's being enacted around our federal system that undermines those manifestations of Indigenous culture. They see it as disingenuous. There are a number of narratives that are scaring the mob, including the when you wake up the next morning scenario, which Frank referred to. There is no date for the referendum. 2017 is not a date that the Prime Minister set. It's a date that was suggested to him, and I think he's right to resist the calls for many of the reasons that you have raised. No referendum date in Australia has ever been set before there's a model. And I think we need a model before we even begin to think about a date. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. The other thing I would say about 67 is this is not 67. There's no visible manifestations of compulsory segregation in the same way that there was at 67. So Australian voters often could see the very physical manifestations of what racial segregation looked like in Australia at the time. Discrimination was a very clear question. 5126 from 10 years out. We knew what the question was. And this time we also have a very burgeoning Aboriginal middle class. So it's a very different situation to 67. And I think we should allow 67 to have its own identity. And I think this is a very different stage for the Australian people. So I don't want to set up that morning after scenario, because I think a lot of Aboriginal people are thinking strategically and politically and legally very carefully and hard about this model. And then on the other hand, there's a lot of people that are chasing the high, the high of this date in 2017. Mob don't want to talk about how I'm going to feel the next morning. You know, we're talking about very hard-headed political people. I mean, last night we heard about the new government tendering policy for Aboriginal business. We have the Noongar settlement in Western Australia, regional governance in South Australia. People aren't desperate for recognition. We're here because of structural issues. So it's serious stuff. And the desire to set the date before a model really reveals a kind of impatience that is bewildering to me. And I think last week on the 7:30 report, an interviewer said to Mick Gooder, the politicians can't move until you get your act together, black leaders get your act together. And, you know, there's a parliamentary committee in play. We're waiting for that report. And I just think it's hugely unfair to put that weight on the backs of Aboriginal leaders. And then Frank, you and others have been able to show your hand on everything before the government even responds to the expert panel and before the committee even reports. But for black people, we have to, you know, get our act together. So that pressure to set the date is really, I think, in a lot of our minds, putting a lot of pressure on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. And it's pushing them into a corner, perhaps to accept something that they just don't want. So I'm not I haven't commented on the model because we're waiting for the committee to release its report, and I promise I'm finishing, Jared. I mean, the substance of the book is really fascinating, which is the interface with the bureaucracy, the bread and butter of Aboriginal Australia. And I think you provided really fascinating insights in the book on the public sector and its engagement with Aboriginal Australia. And there's so few Australians who understand how that system works now, but the interface is now not-for-profits. It's not Aboriginal communities. So it's a very complex environment. But in the kind of suggestions you're making, it's important not to overlook that your proposal is built on quite formal and technical frameworks, and where you have to keep in mind the very informal governance and institutional arrangements that our mob operate in. That is, who has the power and the authority, and how those decisions are made, and how resources are divided in a community. So I will try and get to the end of my without leaving out the very profound comments that I have in embedded in here. Look, I'll end by saying I've been doing this for 4 years now, promoting the work of the expert panel, promoting the notion of constitutional reform without a model, you know, and that's the recommendations that we came to. And a parliamentary committee is now continuing that work and ending that work. But they've been travelling around Australia. And, you know, if you were to go away and do one thing, I urge you to read the Hansard transcripts on the committee website, because you will see that while people will engage with the model if they're asked to, but that's a difficult thing. It's constitutional law. It's not easy. It's not easy for us to do. But in those transcripts, you see a very palpable feeling of voicelessness, of powerlessness, of hopelessness. People feel completely left out of the debate, but they also feel completely left out of, I suppose, the Australian polity. And these kinds of policies we have at the moment, you can't force people to opt in, but you can find ways that they participate in the debate more than what's going on. And I think that while there is support for constitutional recognition in a kind of mainstream sense, what is it that our mob actually think? Do we really know what Indigenous peoples want and what our communities are really thinking? And I think the answer to that is no at the moment. And Frank has articulated point of view from your own considered perspective, and you place the challenge at the feet of Indigenous leaders, which I have to say, whoever they are at any one point in time. But Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have sought a respectful, honest and good faith relationship with the dominant culture, with mainstream Australia, for a long time. Though they are just two very serious documents that are a part of Australia's public infrastructure that remain unimplemented and, I think, actually unread, like the expert panel's report, just unread. To date, that has not been achieved. So we're not there. So debates around the adequacy and completeness of our constitution in today's environment, they're useful and they can contribute to a debate not only about Australia's past and present, but about the future of Australia. So the process is actually about all of us, and calls into question the response of non-Indigenous Australia, who I think equally have not been given the chance to participate. And I don't think it's enough to leave the burden at Indigenous leaders' feet. So my final sentence, I promise, Jared, is our fates are tied to each other. Neither Indigenous or non-Indigenous Australians are going anywhere. So these are the questions that we must address. And as a nation of great public policy innovation, and we are in so many areas, it's bewildering that we can't innovate in this area. And I think it's because of this reason. We know what works, but we resist almost in a kind of involuntary way. We resist all options, but we've tried none of them. Thank you.
Megan Davis, who's not only a law professor but an extraordinary able reader of body language. So look, we've got 20 minutes. And as I said earlier, Frank Brennan's book, No Small Change, is here. Janet Grundy's got copies of that, plus Megan Davis's book, Everything You Need to Know About the Referendum to Recognise Indigenous in Australia. And I'm sure both authors will be happy to sign copies of the book at the conclusion of the question discussion period, which we now start. So I may get Frank, you to stand over here, and Megan, you to stand here. I'll get out of the way and just speak to the camera. And I'll just leave it. Can we have brief, a lot of people here, we don't have a lot of time, so brief comments and brief responses. Now, I don't exactly remember what happened in 77, but I don't think there were any no cases. And in the referendum on Aborigines in 1967, there was no case, or there was a no case on the other matter that was put. It would seem to me that probably now since the Second World War, I'm not aware of any referendum that's got up if there has been a no case. So what's the concern about, what's the likelihood about a no case, and what's the concern about a no case? So firstly, Frank, and then Megan, if you want to talk. Megan, you come back in here.
Well, Jared, just one correction about 1977. I think there were four questions, three got up and one didn't. From memory, one was in relation to House of Representatives and Senate elections always being at the same time. So that was lost. And that was lost even though there was bipartisan support. But it was lost because there was a key group of senators who agitated against it. And so the punters said, we're just not going there, even though the major parties have said they're agreed. So I think that in that case, I mean, you do have a no case. I'm one who's not afraid of any no case being put. We've already heard Cory Bernardi saying, well, he doesn't want anything in the Constitution that mentions Aborigines. I mean, I think there'd be quite a number of Australians who say we want the Constitution to be completely colourblind, no mention of Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. But I do think that the indication is that most Australians would feel better about their Constitution, no matter how much or how little they know about it, if Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders were actually mentioned. So I say bring on the no case, but I think the yes case would be far more compelling.
Megan, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'd just say one thing, and that is I think Helen Irving wrote a very good piece in the conversation, I think, this morning, which provides, you know, quite an interesting, more, I suppose, more nuanced analysis of referendum successes and defeats. I think that what's happened is that people have made a calculation that 8 out of 44 have succeeded. Those 8 had bipartisan support, and people have therefore, you know, forged ahead on the basis of that. Which does lend to a kind of how low can you go to get agreement. It, you know, I think everyone agrees it's a interesting political environment. So I think there hasn't been, I don't think enough, I suppose, analysis or study has been done on what does succeed and what doesn't succeed.
Okay. Down the back.
When we get to constitutional reform, it's not simply that there's a feeling in the community that maybe change should happen. But as with the constitutional debate for Australia to become a republic, the more discussion, the more people get confused. Mm-hmm. And when the issue is put to the people, all kinds of little gremlins come out of their woodwork, and people start to fear they don't really know what they're voting for. Mm-hmm. So what I want to ask is both. For example, if the constitutional referendum had been, do you want an Australian head of state, I think we've got up easily. So what I want you to both say, what is the simplest way in which you could put this proposition to the average Australian so that there wouldn't be confusion and there wouldn't be gremlins?
Okay. The suggestion is, for those who didn't hear, that the more discussion, the more confusion. So what's the simplest way to resolve that?
That is the conventional wisdom. That's certainly the way the campaign is run, which is make it generalist. That's why it's about recognise, and there's no model, and it's kind of amorphous. I'm not sure you can do that with Indigenous populations in Western liberal democracies. I don't. I think it needs to be a much more considered discussion, whether that's a kind of combination of constitution, legislation and other things. But, I'm not sure that it can be done in the kind of way that we tend to run referendums.
For me, Anne, it would be, given that Aborigines are the longest surviving culture in the world, do you want a constitution of the modern nation state of Australia which acknowledges the place of Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders, acknowledges their ongoing relationship with land, and empowers the Commonwealth Parliament to make laws which enhance that acknowledgement.
No, don't sit in front of the camera. Yes, Trevor, here.
One thing that worries me a little bit is the we all would love to see the Constitution changed and to acknowledge everything that you want, but is this a distraction from the real problems in the Aboriginal communities? I mean, if you're in Fitzroy Crossing or in Derby, is this really going to change anybody's life? Shouldn't we be concentrating our efforts to a greater degree on education, rehabilitation, drug control, etc., to actually help?
The suggestion is this might be, the referendum might be a distraction from resolving the real problems in the Indigenous communities.
It may be, but that's why I always say it's not a question of either or, it's both and. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. But I think in terms of the constitutional change, I think from what I've argued as a result of the 67 impetus, there are two huge questions which now confront Indigenous Australia. And the first is the balance between security and utility of land. There are now vast Aboriginal land holdings, but to put it very bluntly, the chief economic empowerment is the negotiating with others to have access to the land rather than the utility of the land for Aboriginal landholders themselves. Now, that requires an enormous rethink of the balance between utility and security of vast land holdings. Now, I think to recast the legal and political arrangements so Aborigines are clearly at the table to resolve that is very necessary. The second is that with increasing problems in regional Australia, the questions about how to resource remote communities for the provision of adequate services is a question which is now acute. And once again, I think that the shortfall is in terms of Indigenous Australians being at the table, being able to make those practical considerations. And therefore, I think as a both and, it can contribute to those practical resolutions on the ground.
Megan, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the things, all the policy triggers that exist right now are aimed at the things that you're referring to, but it's not working. I mean, that's what's happening each year in the Close the Gap report. It's not working, and we have to ask ourselves why. And I think the answer is the structural problem. That's why I argue for a substantive reform rather than just a mere acknowledgement of a culture that exists, you know, a polity that exists in our country. It's not working.
First, I just want to commend Megan on having the curtains changed to support her team. That's quite ambitious. This is just a question around public sentiment. What impact do you think, if any, the apology has had on people's attitudes to constitutional change?
There's two different answers to that. For the non-Indigenous community, I think it's been an important thing. But it's a very complex response that you get if you talk to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people about the apology. So, again, Aboriginal people are very keenly attuned to what works and doesn't work internationally. You know, why Canada, New Zealand, the US have better health outcomes, less disadvantage. One of the things with the apology is while it is one of the most, you know, moving and important things, I suppose, that a Prime Minister has done, there was no compensation paid for that wrong. And I think there's a huge amount of, concern and a lot of people very upset that the vast proportion of the recommendations of bringing them home weren't implemented.
Rick, you want to comment? Okay, so there's a question here. Yeah.
Both of you, are you confident that you can mount a convincing and intellectually sound argument for mentioning race in a constitution?
Well, one of the things the expert panel said was that the notion of race is now outdated, so Section 25 and 5126, which use the term race, would be omitted. And I must say I'm strongly in favour of that. But once you take out the term race, I don't think there's any problem in acknowledging Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. and I don't think there's any problem in replacing what was a person-type power with a power to make laws with respect to things which Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders uniquely have, namely their relationships with their traditional lands and their ongoing cultures, traditions and heritage, which is the one thing which is unique to the Australian nation.
Megan, do you want to come
on? Yeah, I mean, race is a construct, it doesn't exist, so we're talking about a culture, a polity in Australia. So I think what we've done is to avoid that.
So right, down in front of the camera, Jeremy, yeah.
Megan, I just wonder if you've discerned amongst the Aboriginal people any reluctance for change because they themselves are concerned that even if a token reform comes forward, it would be divisive.
Is there any reluctance?
Their reluctance, and legally to you as well.
Let's handle one at a time. Okay, so is there any reluctance in the Indigenous community about this because it might feel that it might,
be
divisive?
I don't know. I mean, I think both people would support a concrete or substantive proposal for reform. It's just, Australia's never seriously entertained that, so, I'm only speculating. But there's always division too. We're no different to any other group in society. We have our differences, and we'll work that out.
There was a question here. Yeah.
What does Best Price think about all this?
What does who?
Best Price.
Best Price think about this? Well,
I can't.
I don't know. I mean.
You haven't asked her.
Well, we may have her at the Institute sometime, but she's not here now. So. Can't do much, but I'm happy to have it here, by the way. There's a question here, yes.
Hi. I think we can be in agreement in some things that, like what Megan says, things aren't working because of structural issues and because Indigenous people don't have adequacy at the table in terms of decision making. So if we need a little bit more time to work out some models, like, for example, what Noel's proposing, shouldn't we take time to see if we can work out something as opposed to working towards this supposed
Okay. Yes.
So the suggestion is that, well, I'm trying to get that picked up on the podcast. The suggestion is that because of the structural problems which are going to take a long time to resolve, that perhaps all this process should be put off until there's time to handle it.
I don't think it needs to be put off. I just think it needs to
put back.
No, it doesn't need to be put back. There is no date. The date was proposed to Tony Abbott and he said he took it on board, but he has never ever committed to it. I think if you go and look at his speech and the transcript of that particular ball where gala where he made that comment, he's never committed to that date. So I think that date has taken on a life of its own because it's a kind of neat date. But I think this process will just take longer. I don't think it's pushing it back. It will just take longer.
Frank?
I'd say two things. First, in relation to the date, I think one reason the Prime Minister has probably embraced it is because of the lack of bipartisanship in Canberra in recent years. It's acknowledged that the prospect of doing anything before the next election is just not on, and that if you could have a model which could be proposed to be brought in the life of the next parliament, then both major political parties could pledge themselves. If they won government, they would see it through, and if they were in opposition, they would not oppose it. And that therefore it was a sensible time frame for saying that this might break the logjam. In terms of whether or not to delay things so as to refine it, particularly in terms of the Aboriginal representative body, I am strongly of the view, and I beg therefore to differ with Noel Pearson, I think the prospect of putting anything like this straight into the Constitution is a gross misconception. I think if you look at the ATSIC experience, then what would be absolutely essential is to set something up with a legislative base and to make sure it works. That is, that Aboriginal people in local communities are happy that here is a model where we know our voice is heard at the national table, and that those at the national table are convinced that, yes, we have the resources needed in order to be able to do this job, and therefore we've refined it, and therefore we can say to everyone in good faith, well, now is the time to put it in the Constitution. But I reckon that would take at least 5 to 7 years.
Are you giving me a minute? No, okay. So we've got a Just a final question to both of you. I mean, start with Frank and then with Megan. Why did you write your book, and what contribution do you think specifically it's going to make? And the same question to Regan about the book you wrote with George Williams. So, Frank.
I wrote my book in the first instance because I said, as a frustrated white fellow who thought that Indigenous policy had gone completely haywire in Australia, I thought it was necessary to try and learn some of the lessons of the white fellows who'd done it very well. And they were Stannard, Dexter and Coombs. Now, they were people of a very different era, but I thought that there were lessons there. Then in the context of the present constitutional debate, I thought that one of the things being lost sight of is that there is extraordinary political momentum which is born of a modest constitutional change, which is overwhelmingly carried, which then provides the imperative for change, but that a council is the catalyst, and an Indigenous council, such as Pearson has proposed, I think would be the catalyst for really fundamental change in the way that we deal with Aboriginal communities in determining policies for the future.
I wrote the book, I became an academic because of these issues of a fascination with democratic theory, public law, constitutional law. It's what I teach, it's what I publish on. So I started well before the expert panel came around, and then I was a member of the expert panel. But what we found as members of the expert panel was a very palpable feeling from non-Indigenous Australians that they didn't really understand Aboriginal history and they didn't understand Australian civics. So what the book tries to do is write in very drill-down layman's way, tries to explain the trajectory of all of this so people can see it's not just something that happened post-67 or it's something that happened with John Howard, but it's actually a trajectory of Indigenous peoples trying to find ways, and the Australian people trying to find ways of better accommodating Indigenous peoples into our democracy. And so I think that's why we wrote the book, and in including arguments for the no case as well, so that it was the kind of book people could use as a useful resource.
Many thanks to both our speakers. In fact, they both spoke for the same length of time, I have to say.
It was
fair.
But
everyone.
You weren't giving him dirty looks.
I wasn't giving you dirty looks. I was actually, but he didn't look at me. He just looked ahead. There you go. I was looking at my watch. But anyway, look, congratulations to both our speakers tonight. We've had two important papers and an interesting discussion. No doubt there'll be further discussions on this matter, but both our speakers have explained the issues remarkably well, that all of us can understand, which in this kind of referendum discussion or leading up to a referendum discussion is enormously important because people can understand what's being said. So, as I said, Frank Brennan's got copies of his book here today, Megan Davies copies of her book here, and to both of you, well done, and we'll have you back sometime. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.